You made it. You've arrived. This is Peter Levitan's Advertising Stories. And you're about to hear entertaining, personal, often instructive stories from deep inside the world of advertising.
Hello. This is Wells Fargo Bank. Please open this important message by sending us your account number and password. Oh, and while you are at it, how about sending us your social security number? Okay, a no-go? Really? How about you send President Mugabe $25,000 for his startup in Papua New Guinea? Or, we can all just go to Amazon and buy a new Apple Watch? I'll need all of your screen names, passwords, credit card and a recent photo of your youngest child. Okay, does all of this sound insane? Well, people deliver this information to strangers every day because they fall for malvertising. Hey, advertisers and publishers and even you, it is time you hear from a malvertising expert. Here is Peter's interview with Matt Gillis, the CEO of Clean.io.
Matt Gillis, who are you and what do you do?
Hey, Peter. Thanks for having me. I am the CEO of Clean.io. We're a company that protects websites and their users from the harmful effects of malvertising. And you may wonder what malvertising is, because it's probably not in the dictionary. It is malicious advertising. The easiest way to explain who I am and what I do and what our company does. If you're ever on a website, you've been scrolling up and down and all of a sudden it redirects you to a page and says, congratulations, Peter, you won an Amazon gift card. Or, Peter, your phone is infected with 39 viruses. Click here because you can remedy that. We prevent all that in real time at runtime. So we make the internet safer. We help publishers save their user experience and preserve their revenue and hopefully preserve their reputation at the same time.
And how often does this happen? I always have this sort of perspective. I'm a baby boomer and I watch the baby boomer world, and it seems like it's the baby boomers in the older generation that falls for the, although I don't see too many of them anymore, you know, the Nigerian email.
Oh yeah. You know,
send me money.
Or your Netflix bill payment did not go through. Click here to give us your credit card data again.
Exactly. So that's happening. That is happening when I go to potentially a publisher website.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it all depends on what websites you go to and where you frequent, but it is actually pretty much everywhere. You know, I think one of the challenges, most people don't understand why it happens or where it comes from. And the reality is this stuff comes through the advertising supported ecosystem. So any website that makes money through ads is at risk. And the irony is the bad actors in the case of malvertising, they're actually buyers. So they are buying ads on websites and using that as a Trojan horse to try and infect your device or create a user experience where they can create an engagement with you and get paid for some event. So my wife, you know, as we're in bed in the morning and she's checking her phone and looking at, you know, the sites that she goes to, it often happens. It doesn't happen all the time, because if it did, you know, it'd be easy to catch and easy to prevent. So these bad actors, what they do is they try and really fly under the radar, like good advertisers would do. They frequency cap, right? And they just try and do it enough to get an ROI, but not do it too much to get caught.
Well, I'm going to use a metric to, first of all, I didn't say this earlier, but of course I'll say it in the beginning, in the end, yada, yada, in the show notes. Clean.io. Is that the name of the company?
Clean.io. Yes.
Clean.io. I love those URL suffixes. Is that what we call them? You know, how they're growing.
Indian Ocean or input output, I think is what they say.
Okay, good. All right, Indian Ocean. I was in India in January, but that's sadly another story. Here's an interesting metric for you. There might be people out there going, well, you know, is this, how bad is this? Is this real or not? You guys have raised close to $8 million in VC funding. That would suggest to me that the market thinks that there is a problem. Is that a good metric?
Yeah, I think that's a valid metric. I mean, I think there's lots of startups that are able to raise a seed round of funding, to take a swing and see if, you know, you've got a good idea that finds product market fit. I think as you move to your Series A, which is what we just recently did, we just raised $5 million. During COVID, by the way, that's a good story. And we can talk about that if you want. But yeah, like, you know, listen, I think it's validation that we have a venture scale business. That's truly what happens when you've raised a Series A round, is that they believe that this can be a big business. And, you know, we've had rocket ship like growth over the last, you know, kind of 2 years that we've been in market with this product. So yeah, I think it is a good KPI.
Do you meet with the VCs online? Is this a virtual VC funding round?
Well, you told me that you love good stories.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, it is a good story. But yeah, we had started to raise our Series A at the end of February. And I had, you know, a week, 2 weeks of meetings booked for New York with all the big VCs. And the week of, which was the last week of February, most of the VCs shut down before anybody else did, because as you can imagine, these guys are like revolving doors of international travelers who are there to shake your hand and meet you and all that sort of stuff. So the VCs shut down early. That pushed our fundraising round, into March. And so I started, at the end of March, met with about 40 different VCs all over Zoom, never met any of these guys in person. We managed over the course of, call it 60 days, to raise our Series A. Still have not shaken people's hands. Doesn't mean we didn't do a heck of a lot of diligence, because by the way, we did. But we just got to know each other in a different way, a real non-standard way of raising money. And I think VCs, and investors are trying to figure out how to proceed in the new norm. So feel fortunate that it's behind us now and we're investing in the future.
Well, it used to, getting funding used to include the visit to, I forget the road in,
Sand Hill Road.
Sand Hill. I've been to Sand Hill Road and I've had some weird, I've raised money in the past and I had some weird offers, you know, that we'll give you $150,000, you know, which means nothing to them. Why? So that, you know, they get a little bite in case something happens. You know, it's the casting, I don't know, rice seeds, you know, on a
no one wants to miss out, and they all want to be able to have your logo on their website.
Exactly. And I'm like, what do I need? I don't need $150,000. Anyway,
yeah, exactly.
That's
yeah,
a whole VC story. Well, congratulations on that. And so interesting, right? Raising money without smelling the other person, which is part of the, you know, I don't want to get too tiger lion land, but you know, we all have ways of checking out other people. But we're going to obviously come back to clean.io, but I want to ask you a little bit. You have a history of building companies. What have you built and sold?
I've been really fortunate in my career. Got my training working for wireless carriers. So I worked for Bell Mobility in Toronto, Canada. I'm Canadian. And then spent a few years at Verizon Wireless down here. You know, so the first company that I was part of that was a success was a video game company in the early days of playing video games on cell phones. This is before the iPhone. So this is when you used to play a video game on your, you know, your LG 6000 or your Motorola Razr. If you remember those devices, they're probably somewhere deep in your drawer there. So we built a company that our biggest game was a TV game show called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. So we were acquired by a Japanese video game company called Capcom, one of the early, I would say, like, you know, console game builders. Their games were like Street Fighter, if you remember that one, in the arcade. Resident Evil, which was made into movies as well. Anyways, they were a hardcore games company. They bought our casual games company because they saw that the world was moving to casual. Actually went into the ads business. So I spent probably the better part of the last 8 years before coming to Clean working for Millennial Media, which was a early mobile ads platform that really helped app developers make money. You know, the app developer ecosystem, I lived it. I think that's one of the reasons why I've had some successes. I've had empathy kind of along the way in living these problems that I'm now solving. But the problem I had at Capcom was we couldn't get people to spend, you know, a dollar to buy a game. You know, everybody goes and buys a coffee every day for $5, but they won't spend $1 on a game that they'll get use out of for a long period of time. So the ad-supported model in the app ecosystem became really important. And it's obviously, it's huge today. It's why all your apps are free that you get to download. So I was with them. We took that company public. We then sold the company to AOL, which was acquired by Verizon. So I ended up back at Verizon, ironically. And then we ended up acquiring Yahoo. So I was really part of a bunch of big fundamental changes in the ecosystem over the last 8 years, specifically in the ads related ecosystem. And just been super fortunate along the way to, you know, really cut my teeth in some of these, I would call them like game changing times, you know, in the world, especially with the evolution of the mobile device and how it's become the epicenter of what you do all day, every day.
Well, I'm going to come back to an AOL story, but since we're on a roll here, this malvertising, I've got to imagine one of your primary platforms is mobile. So how does malvertising, does it work differently on mobile and desktop?
I mean, they don't discriminate. You know, if you think of the bad actors, I think one of the things that's interesting, a lot of people say like, well, how does it work or why does it happen? You know, you need to kind of peel the layers of the onion back to understand who it is that's behind all this. And we'll call them bad actors, but these bad actors are actually performance advertisers, right? So I talked a little bit about how they're the buyers. And quite frankly, they're the most sophisticated buyers on the planet because they're the guys that have figured out how to buy an ad programmatically for, let's call it $1 per 1,000 impressions. Most real advertisers, I know your podcast talks to, you know, advertisers and agencies, and most real advertisers will buy that same ad and they'll cross their fingers and hope that, you know, a half of 1% will click on that ad and engage. But these bad actors have figured out how to initiate malicious JavaScript to actually create a 100% click-through rate. That's why when you're scrolling on your device and it all of a sudden redirects to that you want an Amazon gift card page, that's basically them creating clicks and getting 100% click-through rate. They've got business models on the other side of this thing. So, you know, you'll often see something that might say, obviously not where you're living, you know, hey, we're glad you're a Comcast customer. Please take this survey. And so what they're doing is they're repurposing these, you know, affiliate-based, you know, events into, you know, like a billable affiliate marketing engagement. And so they can target because they know that you're a Comcast customer because you're actually, your device is connected to your Comcast Wi-Fi. They're just very sophisticated in how they operate. So that's really, you know, how it works and why it's a problem. You know, any of these times where you've got these big ecosystem where there's tons of money flowing around, that tends to attract bad guys. So
is this, I'm imagining cross platform. Is it on, is it affect Facebook?
It affects, you know, anywhere where users are engaging, where ads are served, they can buy. And so yes, on Facebook, as you know, I mean, it's a big problem on Facebook. When you are scrolling through your newsfeed on Facebook and either someone has shared a link to a news story or quite frankly, some websites actually buy ads in Facebook to try and get people to come to their site. When you click on those ads or those stories, it effectively launches you to the web page of that website, but it keeps you within that Facebook embedded browser view. So yeah, I mean, like the bad actors, it doesn't matter whether it's desktop or whether it's mobile. You know, think of it like it's offer driven, right? So if somehow the, you know, the profit motive was to get app downloads for a VPN software, and to do that, they have a landing page that says your phone has 49 viruses, they would only target mobile because they would want you to download that app on mobile. In some cases, some of the scams are, you know, on your desktop where it says your Norton antivirus has expired. You know, click here. And often, many times, people will click there because they'll be fearful of what that message is. And, you know, they spoof the experience, they spoof the brand to make it look so real that you would want to click on that. So yeah, it's they don't discriminate. Really, it's all about engagement and ROI. And I think as you think about sophisticated performance marketers, you're going to be very, you know, precise as to where you spend your media. And if you're not getting that ROI, you're going to actually direct your dollars away from non-performing media sources. So, so that's how they operate.
You know, I'm going to divide their skill set into two. One is obviously the technology and the programming that can allow this to happen. And then the second is the creative product that they're putting out there, which is, you know, sometimes almost gets me, and I'm going to say I'm pretty sophisticated. I've been doing this internet thing since the mid-90s, I'll go, oh, it's, you know, Netflix.
Yeah.
And then, I've trained my brain and hopefully my family to realize that, wait a minute, when was the last time Netflix, you know, ever, when do they direct a message to you? Because Netflix is smart enough to say, I don't want to muck this up, right? You know, I don't want you to start thinking that whenever you see my name, you should click on it. So I'm thinking the creative side is pretty special.
Creative side, I mean, well, again, look, like you talk to advertisers and agencies, what's important? The creative, right? That's the thing that you're looking to get the engagement out of. And so, yeah, I think they spend a lot of time and money testing creatives. And I would imagine just like any other great performance advertiser, they're going to run A/B tests and see what works and what doesn't. But yeah, they've really gotten in this mode lately that we've seen, you know, at least in the last year or so, is like really getting sophisticated with their, like how beautiful their creatives look like and look and how, you know, but sometimes I think they have spelling mistakes, you know, just like, like, you know, so like you can tell that it's probably not their first language that they've written it in. So that to me, like the Netflix one always gets me, you know, almost, and then I read it and I'm like, oh, they spelled that word wrong. And had they not done that, they probably would have got me.
Right. Tiger King with a J.
Yeah. You know, it's just, it's too easy, but yeah, no, I think they've spent a lot of time and energy in investing in the technology to, you know, obviously create the engagement and get people to, you know, auto click on things that you didn't click on. And then once they get you to the landing page, it's all about workflow and getting you through that thing to get the bounty that they're looking to get for whatever the engagement is they're getting paid on. So whether it's an app install, whether it's a form fill, like a survey completion, whether it's a let's capture your PII, you know, your email address for a sweepstakes, you know, again, just like any performance advertiser.
Who is their customer?
You know, it's hard to say, but I think their customer or their partner, I would think are some semblance of the affiliate world, where, you know, marketers pay affiliates and then sometimes they lose sight of who gets a hold of those offers and, or how those offers are used. The example that I used about, like, you know, Comcast, I mean, I have had that happen to me where I get redirected to a page when I'm at my home on my Wi-Fi that says, you know, take the Comcast survey. I am sure that Comcast somewhere has gone to a marketing agency and said, listen, if you can get me survey completions from my existing customers and find out how happy they are or you know, what services and features that they would like from us, we'll pay you a bounty for that. And so what happens is I think these affiliate offers kind of get retraded. And lo and behold, now somewhere there's someone that's redirecting users and having a terrible user experience, but landing people on these pages to try and complete a survey. So, you know, I think that's probably where it works because these bad actors aren't calling Comcast themselves because Comcast would probably never take that phone call. But, you know, if the KPI for Comcast is let's get survey completions, well, you know, as you know, there's folks out there that can help you get those.
I'm spinning a little bit. These guys have three things going for them. Data, which is readily available to everybody these days. Great programming. For some reason, I'm visualizing Eastern Europe. I don't know why, other than they, you know, do a pretty good job over there. And finally, creative. So, I mean, that's like the holy grail. I'm sure there's a triumvirate, whatever is the way.
I think there's a fourth leg to that stool, which I think is access, right? I mean, like if you think about it, accessing consumers has never been easier. And over the last 10 years, if you look at how the media world has changed in the last 10 years, obviously, and maybe in the last, I don't know, 15 or so, but like programmatic media, like buying and selling impressions on a unique user basis at real time, at runtime, and that decisioning that happens, and how pervasive that is across the entire internet, across every device. I think the level of access and the openness of that access has really, you know, it's been something that obviously every real advertiser has taken advantage of. And I think even more so the bad actors, you know, it's just such an unlevel playing field for them to go out and attack this ecosystem because you used to have to talk to someone to put an ad on a website, right? You used to have to create an insertion order and, you know, and that world probably didn't play too well for the bad actors. But the moment that you could actually put your hands on keyboards and, you know, set up targeting and, do unique creatives and unique landing pages and really get sophisticated on delivery because of that access, I think that probably changes. And that's why in the last 10 years or so, you know, when I first was at Millennial Media back in 2010, like this was a problem for me in my world back then. And that's how long this has been going on, you know? And we didn't really have the tools to protect from it at the time because the bad actors were really just out innovating, you know? So I think the access to consumers is probably maybe point number one.
Yeah, I'm just going to mention. When I started building websites in the mid-90s, and my the companies that I would look at and learn from were the pornography websites. They were generally way ahead of everybody else in terms of the use of internet-based technology. That's probably another conversation I'll have with maybe Donald Trump when and if he's available.
I'm not really familiar with what you're talking about, Peter, but yeah, maybe.
Just good use of tech, I would say, right?
Yeah. Listen, I think, and figuring out how to do it profitably as well.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, as far as I'm concerned in that world, I think everything's free for the most part. I know there's people that pay, but they've figured out how to make money. And that's the same as the bad actors in this space, is that they figured out how to make money. And that's what makes it so compelling for them. And that's why it's a problem. It's interesting. Like, you know, my family, my friends, they ask me what I do. And when I explain it, they totally get it because it happens to them, right? Like they've experienced it. They felt it, and they felt it on, you know, Comscore top 10 websites. This isn't something that's buried in the underbelly of the internet. This is something that happens, you know, on websites that you probably go to, you know, on a regular occasion.
And how easy or difficult is it to sell into the media companies? They're your primary customer. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so the primary folks that we would sell to are, you know, the media companies, the website owners, the monetization platforms. So the SSPs, I think are also another core area of business for us. How easy is it to sell into publishers? Well, prior to COVID, it was probably a lot easier, right? I mean, COVID has had pretty big impacts on media publishers, but I think at the end of the day, it's really expensive to create great content. It's really expensive to attract users to your properties. And once you've done that, you've got to protect them while you're there. And so most publishers that we talk to about this problem, they totally get it. And they get it because if they don't have protection, you just look at Twitter and their end users will be complaining about it on Twitter, right? So users are pretty vocal, even when it's free. They'll let you know that you got a problem. Most publishers will take this seriously because they want to protect that asset, which is their relationship with their end user.
How has that pandemic thing affected your world?
It's been super interesting to see. When the pandemic hit in, call it, you know, obviously the effects started, but when I think it was maybe March the 10th or something like that, when we all really started going to lockdown, advertisers all, like the big brand advertisers, started pausing their spends, right? And so as you know, in the media business, you know, it's kind of cyclical that, you know, the end of month and end of quarter are generally more active, specifically for brand advertisers that are looking to, you know, spend their budgets. So when a lot of brand advertisers, like, you know, call it travel advertisers, hotel, airline, entertainment, you know, all the things that got shut down, sports, they all started pausing their spends, and that actually created some pretty dynamic challenges for the ecosystem. ECPMs for publishers went down, fill rates for publishers went down. And if you're a bad actor and you're a performance media buyer, like you're looking to try and capitalize on these sort of events. And so we actually saw quite a decent surge in malvertising activity as the pandemic started. So in call it mid to late March and through April, as brand advertisers started to come back and spend started to come back in, call it mid-May, we started to see that threat level start to decline again. But for us, I think, you know, the disruption in the ecosystem peaked, you know, kind of as the work from home and virus took off and the virus lockdown took off. And also, I mean, listen, traffic increased, right? So there's so many different forces that I think made it challenging for publishers. You know, so that's kind of it. And you know, we saw, you know, in key countries where the virus was active. So call it, you know, Western Europe. So Germany, France, Spain, Italy, you know, UK, North America, like that was where we really saw threat levels from malvertising increase over the early days of the virus.
You just raised money. What are you going to spend it on?
Well, in running a SaaS company, most, if you read SaaS blogs, most people say the first thing you need to do is hire a head of marketing. And the crazy part is we didn't do that. We actually like just hired our head of marketing this week, which is kind of crazy. But I think the reason is we really put all of our money into our product. And it sounds cliche, but like we really focused on solving the problem and winning the hearts and minds of our customers. And we figured that if we did that, they would all tell their friends how good we are. And that's exactly what happened. So we've grown to this size where now over 7 million websites have our code running on them, all because of word of mouth. And, you know, we put a ton of energy, not just into product, but into the client success team and into like making sure that, you know, our partners really have the support that they need. And it's resulted in a net promoter score of 86. So we measure our success one of the main KPIs that we look at is our net promoter score, because that's the thing that when you know you've got happy customers and they're going to tell two friends. So what we're going to continue to invest in is product. We've got a couple adjacencies we're looking at and new products that we're going to be bringing out over the next few months. Maybe I'll come back and tell you about those ones, because one is super interesting that I think you'll cool. find exciting. But yeah, you know, just investing in our people and our tech and continuing to scale. So it's pretty simple. You know, if you build the right product, you'll win the hearts and minds.
Yes. I'm sure you don't probably love these guys that produce the advertising, but they'll be around for a while. By the way, I happen to know that your net promoter score is higher than Trudeau's.
Are we going political here?
I'm just trying to prove that I'm an international guy and I can say French names.
There you go. Yeah, right. No, I think we're proud of it. So not afraid to say that.
So this is not a problem. You have to make it happen. Your next stage is awareness and growth within the publishing world. How's your awareness within the advertising world, the ad agency world, we'll say?
You know, what's interesting is most folks, I think, on the advertising side and on the agency side don't really think about this problem, and they really should. The problem that I think most people focus on that side of the world, when you use the word fraud, is, you know, non-human traffic or invalid traffic, right? Nobody wants to be buying ads where it wasn't a real human sitting beside, you know, behind the device with an opportunity for engagement. And by the way, IVT, invalid traffic and non-human traffic, has been a big problem in the industry. And there's a lot of great folks that go out and solve that problem. And we're not one of them. We have not gone and focused on invalid traffic. The problem that we focus on is actually when everybody's deemed that it's valid traffic. It's a real consumer, a real device, a real network. And why I think advertisers and agencies need to think about this and need to ask the questions of whether, you know, the people that they're buying from have this protection is that if you think about it, you know, generally on a web page, there's probably three or four ads. And a bad actor is buying one of those ads. The bad actor generally isn't buying all four of them. Why would they? They don't need to buy all four. They just need to buy one to get that 100% click-through rate. But what that means is that there are three other real advertisers on that page. And what happens when the users are hijacked away to these pages that they can't get back to is that all of the three legitimate ads that were bought on that page are no longer engageable. If you've had the experience yourself, you'll probably know that the back button is usually disabled. Like this is one of the things that the bad actors do is they really lock you in that experience so that you can't get out. And one of the things you probably have to do is either restart your browser or restart your phone, and then you can't get back to that page that you were on. So I think there's a return on ad spend impact that this brings to advertisers that are, you know, hoping for real engagements. So that's one of the things why I think they should be thinking about it. But generally, it's not the first thing on their mind as they're, you know, looking back at their media buys.
Right. Well, it certainly seems like something the major advertisers should be thinking about.
Well, especially if their brands are getting hijacked too, right? I mean, like if you're Visa or you're, you know, American Express or you're Walmart or Amazon or the wireless carriers, your brands are constantly being hijacked in these things because they're spoofing you to try and get engagement. So yeah, I think, you know, a lot more people should be focused on this. And by the way, if there are folks in your audience that you know, are curious about this, I'd love to talk to any of them and really help them figure it out.
Well, I will definitely let the world know who you guys are in on my website and in the show notes. You know, it's always funny with show notes. Do people read them? Who knows? You know, there's so little research on podcasting. It's very interesting for such a growth category.
Exactly.
UX of podcasting remains an unknown. Well, let me say two things. One is, I think what you're doing is fascinating. It's one of those areas that really demands more awareness. And, you know, given the effect of the pandemic on the media world, the media world, the advertising world, the advertising agency world, these guys are so consumed with other things. It's interesting that this is a problem that they're dealing with personally, right? It's not just a business problem. They're dealing with it personally, which is always, always interesting. You know, like, happened to me last week, or my sister clicked on this and now the following is happening. So it's definitely a problem.
Yeah. I say to people, we're so close to these things that we often forget that we're consumers too.
Well, there was David Ogilvy that said, the consumer is your wife, something like that. I don't know the quote. I wanted to, you know, just to make a point. I want to come back to an AOL story, because I didn't want to interrupt earlier. I haven't told a story in a long time. I was the, business development director at Saatchi in 94. So a long time ago. And I was in London. I moved back to New York. I discovered, digital stuff, CD-ROMs, if you remember, right?
And of course.
And then the graphical browser came out, and I said to the agency, we got to get into this. And for many, many reasons, they didn't. So I said, well, I got to get into this. So I found this guy at a company called Redgate Communications, probably something you don't even know about. And I went down to Florida, and it was like the first digital agency. It was owned by Ted Leonsis.
Of course.
Eventually became whatever chairman, who knows what title of AOL. So I go down to Ted and I say, so what is this? He explains it to me. And he says, can I give you some advice? I said, yes, Ted, please. He said, Peter, get the fuck out of advertising. So a year later, I was raising money for things. Anyway, make a long story short, I went into publishing. I worked for Advanced Publications and put their newspapers online. Okay, that was that. A few years later, I, with friends, launched a company called ActiveBuddy, which was in the bot business. You probably played with Smarter Child, which was on AOL and Microsoft. You could talk to a computer using instant messaging. Multiple conversations with AOL, Microsoft, Yahoo, and I thought AOL had to buy us because we had millions of people. We were on their buddy lists, right, in the good old days. And so I am so stressed out as the CEO of this company trying to raise money. I'm walking up Fifth Avenue, the phone rings, and it's Ted. And he goes, hi, Peter, it's Ted. I said, what's up, Ted? You know, like, my heart is in my mouth kind of thing. And he goes, we're not buying you. And all I could say to him is, I said, Ted, 6 years ago, you told me to get the fuck out of advertising. Now you're telling me you're not buying my company. So I...
Help a brother out, Ted.
Yeah, whatever. He said, you know, I'm really sorry. I have to go buy the Capitals or the Wizards right now. I'm a little busy. But here's my point. You've hit some sweet spots, and the clean.io sweet spot sounds like a good one. And I want to thank you for your time. And I also want to look forward to hearing about whatever is up your sleeve, because it sounds like you have sort of large sleeves.
Well, listen, I think similarly, when I left Oath, which was Verizon Media, and after spending the last 8 years in digital media and advertising, I had said, hey, I think I need to do something different. And so then folks look at me now and they say, hey man, you're still in digital media. But the reality is we're actually a cybersecurity company. It just so happens that digital media companies are our customers. So for me, I've gone from this like games to digital media to now cybersecurity. Like, I'm excited about how I've been able to kind of deal with the same sort of customers, but in completely different, a completely different lens of attacking a problem. So yeah, it's, you should have got out of advertising, but you know, hey, sports teams, are they really that lucrative? I don't know about right now.
No, it's sexy, you know.
It is sexy, but God, there's a lot of empty seats.
You know, they're valuable when you sell them, right?
I think so. But listen, I think it used to be all about the media contracts, right? I mean, yeah. that's what the value is in these things. I don't know. User behaviors are all changing. It's not what it used to be.
Well, I'll make two predictions. One, it will all get better someday. And you're in a business that's growing, so I congratulate
Listen,
you.
Listen, the money that's coming into this world, right? I mean, that like bad actors chase money. Why do they go rob banks? Because there's a lot of money there. So I think we're in the right spot. And, you know, the reality is most businesses launch products and move to the next one. And in this business, you cannot do that. You need to launch a product and continue to innovate because the bad actors are innovating faster than anybody else. So for us, this is it's a game of cat and mouse. We're constantly iterating and innovating. And, you know, it's kind of exciting to not know what tomorrow will be like. You know, most would be very stressed by that. But for me, you know, you wake up on a Saturday morning and you're like, oh, wow, there's massive attack last night across these countries. And we were ready for it. So it's kind of fun.
Cool. Well, I like that you're a cybersecurity company. I think you get a higher multiple. And on that note, I'll say thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me, Peter.
And I'll come up to Baltimore sometime. We'll crack some crabs.
Let's go do it. Crab cakes are on me.
All right. Thanks a lot, man.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you for listening to the Advertising Stories Show with Matt Gillis, CEO of Clean.io, about malvertising and the bad boys of the internet. Speaking of bad boys, there will be lots more interesting interviews coming up. So, please subscribe to this show where you listen to podcasts, or we will use your personal credit card to buy Peter a new Model X Tesla. By the way, many thanks to Mr. Robot for helping to produce this show.